You ever Google famous sayings? Probably not. I did this week on Thursday or Wednesday. Here are some famous sayings. See if you know who said them. To be or not to be, that is the question. Who? Shakespeare. Yep, it's in Hamlet. So, yep. I think, therefore I am. Descartes. If you're going through hell, keep going. It's one of my favorite ones. Winston Churchill. A penny saved is a penny earned. Everyone's mom, let's be honest. It starts there, but it was Benjamin Franklin. When the going gets tough, the tough get going. No one knows who said that, but that's a pretty good one. And then lastly, don't count your chickens before they hatch. Myron Heverly. I'll give it to him. We have a text in Ecclesiastes that I'll read it for you, but there's a very famous saying in it, and I'm sure you've heard it before. And it's kind of embedded in the book of Ecclesiastes. There's tons of them, actually, from Ecclesiastes that ended up embedded into the English language. So we're finishing chapter 3, Ecclesiastes 3, verse 16. Moreover, I saw under the sun that in the place of justice, even there was wickedness, and in the place of righteousness, even there was wickedness. I said in my heart, God will judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time for every matter and for every work. I said in my heart, with regard to the children of man, that God is testing them, that they may see that they themselves are but beasts. For what happens to the children of man and what happens to the beasts is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. They all have the same breath, and man has no advantage over the beasts, for all is vanity. All go to one place. All are from the dust, and to the dust all return, dust to dust. Who knows whether the spirit of man goes upward and the spirit of the beast goes down into the earth? So I saw that there is nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his work, for that is his lot. And who can bring him to see what will be after him? Dust to dust. Maybe you heard that at a memorial service or standing beside a graveside. If you're here last week, we did the first half of chapter 3. And the first half of chapter 3 is all about time. And it says, ups and downs, good and bad, joy and sorrow, all of those things are part of the recipe of life. And that we have to learn to trust that God, his work endures, it will be finished, and he will make everything beautiful in his time. It is a brilliant section of scripture, explaining what life is about, explaining what God is going to do. His work in you and me will endure, it will be finished, and he will make you and me beautiful in our time, using the recipe of life. Amazing. Now, the second half of chapter 3 is the exact opposite. It's doubt, it's fear, it's uncertainty, it's unfairness, it's evil. Now, why is that? You like those? First half, brilliant, amazing, everything makes sense. Second half, opposite. Maybe it's like this. You come to a Sunday service, I have, and you're caught up just in God's spirit being among God's people, in a place that's dedicated to God. The praise, the prayers, the preaching, things make sense. You leave with courage. You feel like, yes, I'm gonna keep my eyes on the prize. I'm gonna center myself on what matters. I'm gonna say no to sin. I'm gonna say yes to God. I'm gonna live like a saint this week. And then you walk out these doors, and it's like there's a giant eraser. And by the time you get in your car and you're leaving the parking lot, you're 100% pagan. And then Monday morning, you wake up and you start thinking, what if this is all just a hoax? Doubts and fears and worries start to cloud. You have the same questions that Ecclesiastes has here. Instead of wanting to witness to your coworker, you want to get them fired. Instead of wanting to love your neighbor, you want to move the fence a little bit closer where it's supposed to be. Like, you have the big question Solomon has here, the unfairness of life. People behaving badly, like beasts. And what if there is no afterlife? What if this life is all there is, that when you die, there's nothing else? That we're no different than all the other order, not even created. We're the same as every other animal. We just go dust to dust, and that's it. That God is not using the recipe of this life to finish us, to perfect us, to make us beautiful. We just die, and that's it. It's Solomon's Monday morning doubts. You ever been there? Probably all of us at some point. Because here it's easy to believe. There's something when you're with believers, it's easy on a Sunday morning. But Monday morning, it's different. It's the second half. It's the dark side of chapter 3. And it's deep philosophically. Like it would be a master's class in philosophy. So we're going to hit his three big questions. His three big questions are, why is there injustice, unfairness in life? What about humans behaving badly? And what actually happens when we die? And try to tease out maybe some hope from a pretty hopeless section of scripture. So first, verse 16, it's the unfairness of life. Moreover, I saw under the sun that in the place of justice, even there was wickedness. And in the place of righteousness, even there was wickedness. Injustice, unfairness, things that are just not right. You can probably read the news any week of the year and find some kind of story about a guilty person getting off because of a technicality. That law in America has become so complex that now it is exploited by very guilty people. And even if all the I's are dotted and all the T's are crossed, you still have to get a jury of 12 people to convict. And I think it's been rightly said, a jury is 12 people who are chosen to decide who has a better lawyer. That they can, very often, a guilty person can hire a really good lawyer, and simply because they have lots of money, they can end up walking out free. The guilty walk out free all the time. So 100%. But maybe bigger for us is how life can be unfair. That we can commit to live right. We can commit to turn the other cheek, to prefer others better than ourselves, to live a righteous kind of life, to be honest and hardworking. And you can do all that and still lose. While the rich that are doing things the wrong way are vacationing in Bali, and you can begin to kind of rest on your soul like, this is unfair. And I'll tell you this. Listen to this carefully, tuck this away. The more disciplined you are, the more that you have determined to live selflessly, to deny yourself, to take up your cross, to follow Jesus, to help people, to sacrifice yourself, to read your Bible, to study, the more you're going to do that, the more prone you will feel that life is unfair. Because a lazy person that does not work, that does drugs, that sleeps around, that's dishonest, they expect life to not be unfair. They're like, well, I kind of deserve that. Yeah, I've lived a crummy life. But the guy that says, man, I've done everything right. Why is this happening to me? Read the book of Job. That's what it is. I've done everything right. Why is this happening to me? That's the entire book of Job. I'm the most righteous man on earth. He's not saying that, but he actually was. It's the more disciplined, the more you are determined to live rightly, that you actually see how unfair life is. Does that make sense? That's the way it is. And here's why. I think the default setting on the human heart is what's called the covenant of works. So you read Genesis chapter 2, the very first thing God says to Adam is, do this and live. And I think that set the dial on the human heart. And we still believe to this day, if I just do things right, if I live well, if I'm honest, if I'm hardworking, life will work out for me. Covenant of works. And when it doesn't, there's a part of us that says, this is so unfair. Why isn't this working out right? I ate healthy. I did everything right. I exercised. Why do I have cancer at 50 years of age? It makes no sense to me. So know that, tuck that away. That's what Psalm is feeling right here. Life should pay off. My kids should be perfect. I should have the trophy wife, but it doesn't. What happened? Life is not fair. Don't expect it to be. So in Ecclesiastes, he'll actually hit this in chapter 9. I'll read it for you right now. He says this, again, I saw that under the sun, remember, outside of God's jurisdiction, just the way things actually are, under the sun, the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor riches to the intelligent, nor favor to those with knowledge, but time and chance happen to them all. Life is not fair. Monday morning, when Solomon is waking up, his first thing is like, this just doesn't calculate out. This just doesn't make sense. There's so much unfairness and injustice. His second big problem, humans behaving badly, verse 18. I said in my heart, with regard to the children of man, that God is testing them that they may see that they themselves are but beasts. What's the law of the jungle? Might is right, that's it. If you can, do it. If you're strong enough, take it. That's the law of the jungle. That's the law that rules beasts. They're red in tooth and claw. If you can, do it. If you're stronger, eat them. That's the law of the jungle. Oftentimes, people revert to those same laws. They go back to might is right, and they hurt people. We act beastly. So they have these studies where they will ask people like, would you rather experience physical pain, smash your thumb with a hammer, or emotional pain, relational conflict, whatever it is. And in the moment, the majority of people always say, sticks and stones can break my bones, but names will never hurt me. Emotional pain, I've got no problem with it. I don't wanna smash my finger right now. But what they'll do is this, they'll wait a little while, they do some other things to get your mind distracted, and then they'll start to interview, sociologists will start to interview those same people and try to get them to recall painful experiences in their past. No one talks about smashing their thumb with a hammer. Guess what the pain they talk about that they remember? Emotional pain. Humans behaving badly. How an ex treated them. How a parent dissed them. How a teacher dishonored them. It's always emotional pain. It's humans behaving badly. That's what happens. And even if it's accidental or not on purpose or a mistake, it still hurts us. Happens all the time. Sometimes in humorous ways. I'll give one example. So a couple of years ago, Myron, my son, was in swim lessons. And so I went to watch him. It was a week long. I went to, on a Thursday, it was at noon, went to a caveman pool, and they have some bleachers set up, and I was probably one of 20 parents sitting in these bleachers. And then there's a little bit of space, and there's a fence, and then there's about 20 feet of concrete, and then the swimming pool. And in front of the fence were these two chairs, maybe they're 8-10 feet apart. And it was two older people, a grandpa and a grandma. And they're sitting there in front of the fence watching, I suppose, a grandson or a granddaughter swimming. And then there were some kids kind of playing around. And one of them must have been his granddaughter, because she's talking, she's, "Grandpa, grandpa, grandpa." And she had a voice that carries. She did not need a megaphone. She was a megaphone. Like, go into broadcasting, because wow, you have got a voice. So she's there with her grandpa, and then she said something, and her grandpa starts to laugh, and she looked at her grandpa and said, "Grandpa," in that voice, "your teeth are yellow." Yeah. And so all the 20 of us are just like, all of us, you can see everybody that was smiling, just all of a sudden you close your mouth. I do not want to see my mouth. And then she climbed up on her grandpa's like lap and is like looking at his teeth. "Grandpa, your teeth are yellow, yellow, yellow." And then grandma, who's like 10 feet away, she's like, "Grandma, grandma," who was sleeping at this point, like she just slumped out. "Grandpa's teeth are yellow." And you can just see, this guy's like nicely dressed. You can see the back of his ears are just turning red, right? Like, I'm like, oh man, this is so bad. So she goes, "Grandpa, why are your teeth so yellow?" And the grandpa's like trying to like, you know, shuffle this. He's like, "Well, it's just because I eat yellow snow." Yeah, I know. Like, that helps, dude. So the girl said, "No. Your teeth are yellow because you don't brush your teeth. You have yellow, 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 yellow teeth." And then about this time, like the younger brother of the broadcasting girl comes walking by. She's like, "Come here, come here. Look at grandpa's teeth." And so the little boy climbs up. He's literally like probing into grandpa's mouth. Like, wow, they are yellow, yellow teeth. And this went on for, it felt like 70 hours. May have been like 2 minutes, but it felt like eternity. So by God's mercy, it stopped. But then grandpa made a mistake. There's another child, like a teenager that must have been related to him, because he calls over and is like, gives her some money and says, "Hey, can you go over and buy me an ice cream?" Broadcast girl hears that, whirls around. "No, grandpa, you cannot have ice cream. You have yellow teeth and you need to go to the dentist." The final scene is the little boy is skipping in front of us on our side of the fence, and he's singing a song. "Grandpa has yellow teeth, grandpa has yellow teeth," skipping along in front of us. Sometimes you can get hurt pretty bad, even on accident, by people we love. And we get pain from them. This is what Solomon's talking about. People that are created as image bearers of God, supposed to be reflecting his goodness, his grace, his mercy, his kindness, end up acting like beasts. Not image bearing God, not being kind and forgiving, not overcoming evil with good. We end up becoming like beasts. It's why we lock our doors at night. It's why we make people that are going to be around children take background checks, because there's too many beasts posing as image bearers. And Solomon says it doesn't make sense. Why are there so many beasts out there? And then question number three, what happens when we die? Verse 19. "For what happens to the children of man and what happens to the beast are the same. As one dies, so dies the other. They all have the same breath, and man has no advantage over the beasts for all his vanity. All go to one place. All are from the dust, and to the dust all return. Who knows whether the spirit of man goes upward and the spirit of the beast goes down into the earth?" When you die, what happens? You ever thought about that? You ever stood beside a graveside and wondered? What happens when I die? Is there eternity? Is there not? Do you just go to dust and that's it? Every culture wrestles with this. Every one of us will ask this. Monday morning doubts, this is a big one. And cultures have traditionally fallen on one of three areas. There are some minors in there, but there are three big answers to what happens when you die. Number one is the immortality of the soul. That in Genesis 2, when God breathes into the dirt, the dust, living ruach, the ruach, there's a part of the human that becomes eternal. It's immortal. It lasts forever. And there are those that argue that the Old Testament never teaches the immortality of the soul. That is a New Testament idea that Christians bought, but the Old Testament does not teach resurrection, does not teach the lasting part of the soul. I always turn them to what Jesus says, because he's asked by a group of people called the Sadducees, and the Sadducees did not believe in the resurrection. They did not believe in the afterlife. It was, you just become dust. When you die, that's it. And so Jesus' answer to them is Matthew 22, verse 32. Listen to what he says. As for the resurrection of the dead, have you not read what was said to you by God? I am the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and the God of Jacob. He is not God of the dead, but of the living. He quotes Exodus 3:6. When God speaks to Moses out of the bush and he says, I am the God of Abraham. Not I was the God of Abraham, but he's been dead for 2,000 years. I am right now the God of Abraham who is in my presence. So Jesus uses the Old Testament to say, oh, there's a resurrection. So the Christian view is immortality of the soul. That's option one. Option two, reincarnation. And know this, what a society broadly believes about the end of life really matters. So India is a Hindu nation. Predominantly, everyone there is Hindu. There's a minority of Christians and a minority of Muslims there. But primarily, it is Hindu. And Hinduism believes in reincarnation. That literally, better luck next time. And however you lived in the first life or your previous life is going to echo out into this life. So if you lived good and righteously and kindly, then you level up. But if you live horribly and terribly, then you level down. So whatever happens to you, man, you deserved it from the previous life. And it changes a society. So the last time I was in India, I actually took my whole family. And we went to this place called Spencer's Plaza where they sell these really great shirts for cheap. So I went there, I bought a bunch of shirts. I was really happy. They're like $4 a piece. And I'm leaving, and there was a beggar out in front, and he was in the worst shape I have ever seen of a beggar. Like, I could not understand even how he was alive, because right after his rib cage, it's just like his whole body shrunk down to the size of your backbone, essentially. Just disappeared. And then his legs just, they didn't even make sense how they could work. And one of his arms was completely useless. The other arm was contorted. And I was like staring at him. I think Charity actually nudged me like, stop staring. I'm like, I just don't even understand how this works. So I got out like 100 times what you should give to somebody, and I gave it to him. And he can't talk, so it was just no problem. I go 20 feet from there, turn a corner, and you know, in third world countries, there's vendors everywhere. There was a vendor who was selling all these bumper stickers, and almost all of them were in Tamil. But there was one right in the middle that was in English. And it said this, beggars are fools, and only fools give to beggars. Now, why would you have a bumper sticker like that? Reincarnation. This guy must have done something really horrible in a previous life, and God is now punishing him and making him come back like this. So it's not the brokenness of this world. It's not the brokenness of DNA. It's not that there's real evil in this world. It's not that there is a real kingdom of darkness that wants to steal, kill, and destroy. No, you did something bad in a previous life and you deserve whatever you're getting right now. It's why they have the caste system in India. If you do well, you level up in the caste. You'll come back, level up. If you do bad, you level down until you become an unseeable. You're not even allowed out at day. You have to stay inside until it's dark, and you come out and do all the jobs no one else wants to do. Bad theology has a body count. It matters what you believe. Just look at the nation of India. I've been there many times, many times. Third one, it's called eternal oblivion. It means this: when the brain ceases its chemical processes, that's it. There's nothing else. There's no eternity. There's no anything after this. It's materialism. It's also called extinctivism. That we're just random mutations that turned into this life. And when those random mutations run out, when the chemical processes stop, that's it. There's nothing else. No afterlife. We cease. To dust we go. And that's the end. Which I always think, like, people that believe that. So you have Hitler, responsible for the death of millions, destruction unparalleled because he had weapons that no one else has ever had, and he was willing to use whatever means possible. Kills millions. He has the exact same end as your really nice next-door neighbor who's super kind, who believes all roads lead to heaven or all roads lead to God, and be nice and love your neighbor as yourself. He's the sweetest person in the world. They have the same end, just back to dust. Wow, that leaves to me just a gigantic cosmic problem. So those are it. Now, if you believe there's no afterlife, what does that theology do to a society? Solomon gives us the answer. So I saw there's nothing better than a man should rejoice in his work, for that is his lot. Who can bring him to see what will be after him? Just enjoy. It's called Epicureanism. Solomon was the first Epicurean. Eat, drink, and be merry, because tomorrow we die. Just go rejoice and have as much fun as you can, because this is it. And when this is over, that's it. Epicureanism. There was a time in my life where I was an Epicureanist. I went to Oregon State, took a class. You guys know this probably. It destroyed my faith. I had serious doubts. I had doubts about everything. I was right here Monday morning. I lived in this for some time. Just doubts about everything. And then I had a great conversation with a phenomenal philosopher. His name is Dwayne Londigan. He was one of my six roommates. And he was the happiest of the six of us. Dwayne Londigan was the funnest guy to be around. He was always just fun. And I'm just in the despair of doubt. And we didn't really have a kitchen table to sit at. So we'd kind of eat in the living room. We'd just have kind of bowls and we'd stand around and eat and talk. So it was one of those mornings, I think I'm eating Wheaties or something. I'm in there, I'm just kind of grinding on things. Dwayne's in there too. And I said, you know what, Dwayne? I said, I just wish life was, you lived it and you died and that was it. That you had as much fun as you could have in this life, and when it's over, that's it, you're done. And Dwayne, who's normally like the most chill, happy guy in the world, he just stopped eating, looked at me, go, really, Matt? Okay, then you better go have fun. You better have as much fun as you can. What are you doing right now? You're wasting time. Time is a limited commodity. You better get there and have fun, 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 fun. If someone is having more fun than you, you better figure out who that is and figure out how to have more fun than them. You better never sleep in 1 second because you're missing out. Time is a limited commodity. You better have fun. You better get out there right now. Stop eating your meal and go have fun. And I was like, chill, bro, man. You've thought about this, haven't you? And he said, that would be an exhausting way to live. I said, whoa. Brilliant. Brilliant. Yeah, that would be an exhausting way to live. Albert Camus, a literal, famous philosopher, said this. Said, imagine you doing the thing that you enjoy the most, whatever it is, the most fun activity you could ever imagine. And then imagine somebody has a gun to your head and tells you, for the next hour, enjoy that activity as much as you can. Would you be able to enjoy that activity with a gun to your head? Well, no. Albert Camus said, death is the gun to every person's head, and it's the reason why you can't enjoy life. And if you think it through, it's true. It's true. Epicureanism doesn't work. Matt, this is a very depressing message. I know. But there's a hidden gem. It's one where just for a moment, Solomon like snaps up and it's verse 17. Listen to what he says. I said in my heart, God will judge the righteous and the wicked. For there is a time for every matter and for every work. I just call it his doubtful hope. In the middle of his Monday morning, just his questions and his, for a moment, it says he said to his heart, he's preaching to himself. We need to learn to actually preach to ourselves when we're in the middle of doubt. Sometimes we need to doubt our doubts. Just because you have a doubt doesn't mean it's true. Like, learn to doubt your doubts. Learn to preach to your own soul. Like, hold on a second. Hold on a second. And for just a moment, Solomon goes, I'm trusting, maybe doubtfully, maybe tenacious, maybe just holding on by a thread. I'm trusting that God's gonna make this right somehow. That all the wrongs that I see, all the unfairness, all the injustices will be made right somehow by God. And then he goes back into his doubts. You know how important it is to believe that? That God will make things right? You know how that changes you? Changes the society. So there's this famous philosopher. He works at Harvard. His name is Miroslav Volf. He writes a lot about forgiveness. Like, it's brilliant. His stuff on forgiveness and reconciliation are unbelievable because he lived through the ethnic cleansings in the Balkans in the 1990s, where Slobodan Milosevic, a communist socialist atheist, just went through and said, we're eliminating all the people that we don't like. Any ethnicity that we don't like, we're killing them all just systematically. Just a modern day Hitler. And so Miroslav Volf writes about that time. And he says this, that regime, he said, they did what they did, not because of a belief in divine judgment, but because of a lack of it. They were atheists. They didn't believe there's any God. We can do what we want. Might is right. We'll act like beasts because we can. And then he argues, the only way that you can help somebody not get vengeance is a belief in verse 17, divine judgment. God will make things right. And so he says, imagine, and he had to do this, talking to a young man who comes back to his house and Slobodan Milosevic's crew has come through and killed every single one of his family members. They're all dead in his house. How do you talk that young man out of going and getting vengeance? What do you say to him? Vengeance never solved anything? You're like, oh, yes, it does. They poked out one eye, I'm taking out two of theirs. He goes, the only way you can talk them out and the only way I could talk young men out of it was to say, there is a God who sees. There is a God who knows. And there is a God who will act. And you have to trust him. That the wrath of God is a necessary part. The reason why the Bible talks tons about God's wrath, read the book of Revelation. It's the last book. And what is it all about? God's wrath. That the time has come. That wrath has to be poured out now. That things have to be made right. Injustice and unfairness has to be made right. That God hates it as much as you and I do. That God is patient, no doubt. He's long-suffering, but at some point those things run out and God says, I will make this right. And over in the book of Revelation, the people that are watching, both saints and angels say, righteous and true are your judgments, O God. You made it right. We have to know that. And Miroslav Volf would say, it is a belief in that that allows forgiveness to actually happen, to release whatever that person has, whatever you have against that person, however they hurt you, whether it was yellow teeth or something a lot worse, the only way that you're going to forgive them and release that is to believe in verse 17, I said in my heart, God will judge. God will make it right. It's Romans chapter 12. Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. I will repay. Okay, so you do not be overcome of evil because you start harboring that stuff in your heart. You start letting that dig its roots into you. You become a different kind of person. Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. So do not be overcome of evil, but overcome evil with good. Only way it works. To say, verse 17, to preach it to yourself. Okay, God, you're gonna make it right. And the truth is, even though Solomon was down it right here, you and I, we will last forever. And you and I, what I'm doing right now, if it was just for 70 years, big whoop, it's not. How I live right now is going to echo for the next billion years. And it matters then. I'm crafting the character that's going to exist for eternity. And it matters. And if you don't believe that you last for eternity, just do a deep search on near-death experiences. It's some of the most fascinating stuff in the world. Like, they're coming up with more and more data on it right now. But one of the most famous studies is Pam Reynolds. Google her. Double aneurysm. She literally is cooled to 60 degrees. Her blood is like drained from her body. She's put this thing over her head. These loud earphones are put on her ears because they want to see if she has any brain activity. So like every second, it puts this loud click, 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 click. And they're monitoring just flatline brain, flatline heart for hours. And Pam Reynolds was able to tell exactly what had happened to her because she said, I was hovering over the table watching everything happen to me. She recounts a nurse commenting on how big her arteries are. She talks about how she watched the surgeon and the exact operation he was doing because of her aneurysms. Stuff that there's no way she could know unless she was literally hovering above her body. Look at that. Look at Dr. Egan Alexander, a neurosurgeon, 100% atheist, doesn't believe anything. And then 2008, he has his own near-death experience. And he wrote a book called Heaven, or Proof of Heaven, A Neurosurgeon's Journey into the Afterlife. Or you can write, there's a book called Imagine Heaven, and it's 100 near-death experiences. But one of the most interesting thing is, they test people after they have a near-death experience. The brain of people that have gone through a near-death experience are fundamentally different than your brain and my brain. Like, they have tasted and seen eternity, and it's left a fingerprint on their brain itself. They dream different than you and me. Something's fundamentally changed. We're eternal. The soul is immortal. And it's so important. Paul puts it like this in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. I'll read it for you. And if Christ has not been raised, then our preaching is in vain, and your faith is in vain. For if the dead are not raised, not even Christ has been raised. And if Christ has not been raised, your faith is futile, and you are still in your sins. Then those also who have fallen asleep died, and Christ have perished. If in Christ we have hope in this life only, we are of all people most to be pitied. You're eternal. Your soul is immortal. The only question is, where will it reside? It is going to go somewhere. The only question is where. Will it go to be in God's presence, where there's love and life and light? Or will you go where there is no God? Because hell is the absence of God. Everything that is God, if you removed it, what's left, the shell that's left, is hell. That's what it is. So instead of light, it's darkness. Instead of life, it's death. Instead of love, it's apathy, indifference, hate. Instead of peace, it's chaos. Because everything that is God and good is removed. It's people that say, I don't want anything to do with God. And God says, okay, you can have a place where I am not. And everything that I am is removed, and the shell is hell. That's what 2 Thessalonians chapter 1, verse 9 says, apart from the presence of God. That's the only question. But the good news is, You can, I can become a citizen of heaven. Spend eternity in God's presence by faith in Jesus Christ, his death, burial, and resurrection on my behalf. It's that simple. It's faith in him. And I pray every single one of you has made that decision. I want to spend eternity in God's presence. I'm spending it somewhere. Might as well be in God's presence. And we celebrate that and remember that every Sunday by coming to the table and remembering the work of Christ on our behalf and how it is echoing out through all eternity.